horses. They were all a little gentler, but cautiously so. He took a deep breath. "I'm sorry, sir, but I don't think you do understand what Fagulla is up to." "Oh?" Mikhail produced the list of addresses that he'd taken from Fagula's house. The paper was stained black with his blood. He handed it to Tenik, who examined it with a frown. "That," Mikhail said, "is what I found among Fagula's papers. It struck me as important at the time, so I confiscated it. But I was shot before I could give it a second thought. In my weakened state, I didn't grasp the significance of the addresses until the morning of the bombing, and that's when I attempted to reach the house to warn you."
"What is that?"
Yarit asked Tenik.
Tenik's eyebrows rose.
"It's a list of addresses, corresponding to every single one of the bombings, including the one that destroyed our house.
You'll find that the handwriting matches the writing in Fagula's pocketbook," Mikhail said, trying not to sound smug. Three of Yarit's lieutenants began to mutter. A fourth gasped openly. Yarit stilled them with a raised hand. "And?"
"I propose that Fagula has been working with Mahoosh and the Black Hats. She struck a deal with them to kill as many of Sidiel's enemies as they could. I've no idea what the Black Hats are getting in return, but it's clear from that list of addresses that she knew ahead of time where they would occur. I'd be willing to bet that Mahoosh, or Jatura, has a matching list."
Yarit nodded at Tenik, who slipped out of the room without a word. Mikhail opened his mouth to ask where Tenik was going, but Yarit cut him off.
"You're accusing Cassadiel of treason?"
"I am," Mikhail said. "Fagula ran the errands, but it's too convenient of a pattern for Sedyal not to have given the order."
"Would he dare?"
one of the lieutenants asked. Yarit tapped a finger against his chin, staring over Mikhail's shoulder at nothing, a scowl etched on his face.
"Sedyal has dared an awful lot. He would never risk the Empire. If all of this is true, he probably has a plan to eliminate the Black Hats as soon as they've served their purpose. But he's never been above destroying his enemies."
"All of that was supposed to change with the war. We were supposed to be united,"
another of the lieutenants growled. Yarit didn't answer him. Somewhere in the bank, Mikhail thought he heard a scream. He tried to ignore it. He was completely certain of this conspiracy now. It made too much sense, and it was clear from Yarit's body language that he wouldn't be hard to convince. Not with the evidence Mikhail had just put in front of him. Yarit meditated in silence for several minutes, his eyes half-lidded in thought, while his lieutenants avoided Mikhail's gaze. When the quiet had almost become unbearable, the door opened and Tenik returned just as suddenly as he left. He held a leather pocketbook, Fagula's, in one hand. He plucked the blood-stained address list off the table and compared the two, then nodded.
"The handwriting is a match."
"And Mahoosh?" Yarit asked.
"He's changed his story."
Mikhail perked up at this. "Mahoosh is here?"
"You can tell him,"
Yarit said to Tenik. Tenik nodded, then turned to Mikhail.
"We brought Mahoosh in the evening after the bombing and handed him over to our own household questioners. His story has corroborated the story Fagula told us, that you are still a loyal Black Hat spying on the Dionys. But I just went to him with the story you told us, and he broke down. He said that Fagula has been funneling the Black Hat's supplies in exchange for conducting bombings at the addresses and dates she gave him. He even told me where to find a copy of that list you brought us."
Mikhail allowed himself to close his eyes and let out a sigh of relief. When he looked up, Yarit was smiling at him thoughtfully.
"I'm glad you're still one of us,"
Yaret said. Mikkel swallowed his guilt, pushing his real self deeper into the back of his head.
"I'm glad I had evidence that Fugula is a lying sack of shit. What do we do now? Is this enough evidence to accuse Sedil?"
"I think it is," Yaret replied. Tenik raised his eyebrows.
"That will be dangerous."
"Dangerous or not," Yaret said with a shake of his head, "Sedil must be brought to heel." Mikkel was hit with a sudden sense of foreboding.
"Perhaps Tenik is right," he said.
"In what way?"
"That it's damn dangerous. Too dangerous. Sedil is the Emperor's man, right? And he commands the armies and the privileged. If we go after him openly, if we force him into the light, he may just crush us underfoot. It would be his only option."
"He tried to kill me," Yaret said quietly. "He tried to kill my household. I will not let this stand."
"We won't," Mikkel assured him.
"But I think I know of a way we can punish him without forcing a more deadly confrontation."
"I'm listening."
Mikkel took a deep breath. This idea would lessen the ugliness, but it would also make Mikkel another very powerful enemy.
"When is the next public event where both Sedil and Fugula will be present?"
Chapter 42. Flora did as she'd promised Taniel and changed hotels. She rushed a new order of clothes from a local tailor and changed her look, and generally kept her head down so that she could gamble her week on the only real chance she felt she had to find the stones, reconnoitering Nighttime Vale. Flaring's description had been spot on. The vale was approached by a steep hill on the northern edge of town and entered through a narrow valley between two great pillars of stone. Because the vale was entirely the property of Jezzy's shovel gang, the valley was closed to outsiders and guarded by 8 armed men at all times. Flora watched them for 2 days and nights, attempting to find some kind of chink in their routine that would let her slip into the vale and back out again without being noticed. She grew more and more frustrated at the situation. The approach was out in the open. The guards were rotated in shifts without a gap, and every wagon that entered and left the vale was guarded to and from the destination. According to a few old prospectors she asked, climbing around the other side of the vale would take her 4 or 5 days. She began to wonder if maybe Jezzy was in on the recovery of the stone, or if it was just that gold mines were more thoroughly guarded than some military armories. Bad luck either way. On the third day, she picked up a copy of the Yellow Creek Caller to find a surprising bit of information on the front page. The headline read, "Mercenary Army Marches on Yellow Creek." Below was a snappy story on the Riflejacks that said they were spotted in the region marching toward Yellow Creek. She returned to the newsy boy who'd sold her the paper and pointed at the headline.
"Is this from this morning?"
"Yes, ma'am, fresh information."
"Do you know anything else about this?" she asked.
"I don't think so."
Flora fished a coin from her pocket and flicked it off her thumb. The boy caught it, looked over his shoulder, and took 2 steps closer. He spoke in a conspiratorial tone.
"Rumour has it, the big bosses are frantic with worry. Each of them thinks the other hired a whole mercenary army to take their gold, and both of them are denying it. I heard that it was Jezzy who hired them. Supposedly, the army's led by that Flint lady, you know, the one that the Lady Chancellor's put a bounty on."
"I've heard of her," Flora said cautiously.
"Well, everyone is arming up to protect their claims. The big bosses are forcing a production increase and offering huge amounts to anyone who carries a weapon.
The guards are Dublin. The mayor wants to close all the roads, but Jesse and Brown Bear Bert want to keep them open to get the gold out. They say it's chaos in the mayor's office and no one knows what to do.
Laura left the newsie with an extra coin and strode off, swearing under her breath. This was exactly why she'd come ahead of the army, exactly why she'd given herself an extra couple of weeks to try to find the stone before they were forced to bring in a few thousand soldiers and dig it up with violence. She originally thought that the town's defences would be little more than an inconvenience, but now she wasn't so sure. Roadblocks in the harsh terrain could keep the riflejacks from approaching the city for days or weeks, and when they finally arrived, they would have to deal with street-to-street fighting with people who thought they were there to steal the gold. Flora headed to the main street and checked in with the messenger service that she'd used to try to find Olam. The man behind the desk recognized her immediately and went to a locked box in the corner of the room, returning a moment later with a letter.
"It came yesterday," the clerk said apologetically. "We checked with your hotel, but they said you had left and not given them a forwarding address."
Laura tipped the man and took the letter to the corner. She recognized Olam's writing immediately.
"Progress has been slow. Took a circuitous route to a port from the east. News from landfall. We are 5 days out. I fear word has gone ahead of us. Expect panic. We'll hold at 6 miles and wait for orders." "A little damn late," she said, lighting the edge of the letter with a match and letting it burn down to her fingertips.
She did some quick mental math and decided that they were probably getting close to that 6 miles. Making camp 6 miles out could be good, though. It would give the city residents longer to worry about why they were here and who had hired them, which in turn would give Laura more time to find the stone. If the picks and shovels began fighting among themselves, the riflejacks might have an easier time of mopping things up. But none of this, she decided, was ideal.
Chapter 43 Mikhail sat in the hallway outside of the war game arena in the Capitol building, listening as the cheering came to a great crescendo, before tapering off into the general cacophony of loud conversation that he normally associated with a period at the end of a boxing match. He wondered briefly who won, before reminding himself that he didn't know who either of the players were, or most of the rules of the game. Maybe if he stuck around here long enough, he would learn how to play.
Mikhail took a coin out of his pocket. He flipped it, caught it, and looked at the result. How, he wondered, did Tenek resist looking at that result every time? It was a natural human urge, wasn't it, to know how something ended? Before Mikhail could ponder the question further, the doors opened and a stream of people began to pass him. No one seemed to really notice his presence, which, he decided, was probably for the best. He recognized most of the people either from the game he had attended the other week with Tenek, or from figures he'd seen stalking these very halls over the last couple of weeks. The cream of the Dionysus crop. If Jatura really wanted to cause some damage, he would toss a couple of grenades into that room during a war game. Mikhail wondered if that would be on the list, eventually. Mikhail spotted his target and climbed to his feet, body still hurting from Ictracia's healing, the pain kept partially at bay by horn gum. His hands shook slightly from a case of nerves, and he wondered why he was here rather than standing in a dark corner to watch the proceedings. He reminded himself that he'd made plenty of accusations before. This was just far more public than he was used to. He would just have to get used to it.
"Fagola!" he called sharply.
The people closest to him stopped in their tracks and turned, some of them doing a double take as they saw him. Fogula, her head bowed to listen to the words of a woman beside her, searched for the source of the summons until her eyes met his. All around her, the stream of people gradually ground to a halt. Her lip curled slightly, but she bowed her head again and nodded to the man to go on, turning a cold shoulder toward Mikkel.
"You probably shouldn't enjoy this," Mikkel whispered to himself, stifling a smile.
"Devin Fogula, a sedial," he barked.
Everyone had stopped by now. People were looking curiously between Mikkel and Fogula, the latter of whom finally pulled herself away from her companion and strode through the crowd toward Mikkel. She came up sharply, chin raised, glaring down her nose at him.
"Shouldn't you be in a cell, spy?"
"Not me," Mikkel said, tapping the front of his jacket.
She looked down, seeing the way he was dressed for the first time. A teal uniform, worn by ministerial servants on official business. It was similar to a Dainai soldier's outfit, though the cut of the pants was slightly different. This one had been tailored specifically for Mikkel just yesterday, and it fit him rather splendidly. The jacket bore the crest scroll of Yeret's household, and beneath that, a small stitched cup.
"Why are you wearing that uniform?" Fogula demanded.
She scowled at him, and he could see the first inkling in her eye that she knew something was off.
"You have no right."
"I have a lot of right," Mikkel responded. "I saved the Yeret household from a bombing."
"Haven't you heard?"
Mikkel knew for a fact that she hadn't heard. The last time she saw him, he was being carted off by Ectrasia just before the bombing. At his request, everything about his activities the last few days had been kept quiet. As far as anyone knew, Yeret had barely escaped the bombing because of an anonymous tip, and the Black Hat spy, Mikkel Bravis, was in Yaret's custody and being questioned.
"You didn't save them?" Fogula said.
She was uneasy now, lacking conviction. This had taken her completely by surprise.
"Don't smile, Mikkel."
"I did, actually."
"You remember that day, don't you? It was just earlier this week. You and your cronies tried to chase me down, even though I could barely walk. It's all right, though. Fortune smiled on me, and I still managed to warn Yeret about the bomb."
"You could only know about that bomb if you were the one to plant it."
Everyone was watching now, as if glued to the floor. There wasn't a sound within 40 feet as people strained to hear the conversation. Mikkel was using his best Dainai's, though he had to throw in a paler word once in a while. He was certain that everyone was getting the gist.
"Oh," Mikkel said, "I found this."
He drew out the list of addresses he had stolen from her files. It was fragile from being caked with his dry blood, so he presented it to her in a stiff folder. She reached for it involuntarily, and he snatched it away.
"This," Mikkel said, "is a list of addresses that includes..."
"I know what that is,"
Fogula hissed, glancing desperately at the crowd around her. Mikkel went on in a louder voice.
"It's a list of addresses that includes every location that has been attacked since the bombing started. It was found among your files last week, and is written in your..."
"Shut up,"
Fogula said, grabbing Mikkel by the wrist.
"Unhand me," Mikkel responded coldly.
"Give me that."
Before he could stop her, Fogula snatched the folder out of his hand and opened it up, staring at the list of addresses. There was a rustling nearby, and several soldiers took up positions along the edges of the hall, watching Fogula carefully.
Mikkel almost wanted her to run, just to see what would happen.
Yeret had ordered his men to be emphatic, if necessary. Mikkel took a half step toward her and lowered his voice so that only she could hear.
"The thing is, if you're going to spread a rumour that I was shot by a Black Hat, You should consider the fact that there were no other witnesses besides me and the shooter. And you didn't hear about it from me. Also, having me shot by a black hat contradicts your story that I'm still working for them. Never cross your narratives, and, he tapped the folder in her hands, never keep a copy of addresses where you intend to have people killed.
To Mikkel's left, a door opened and Tennik emerged with four more soldiers, taking up a position close enough to snatch Fagula if she attempted to attack him. There was a sudden commotion, and then three emphatic clicks on the marble flooring. A corridor opened in the throng of people to reveal Kaa Sedil standing just inside the wargame arena, a scowl on his face, quietly demanding to know what was going on. When his eyes fell on Mikkel and Fagula, he immediately began to stride toward them, cane in hand. Ictrasia stood just behind him, following with a curious look on her face. Mikkel swallowed his nerves and glanced at Tennik, who gave an almost imperceptible nod. Waiting until Sedil was almost upon them, right as Kaa's mouth opened with a demand, Mikkel gave a quick, respectful bow and spoke first.
"Great Kaa, thank you for coming. We have a grave matter to bring to your attention."
Kaa Sedil glanced from Fagula to Mikkel to Tennik, the irritation on his face fading to something more neutral in the space of an instant. The old bastard knew a trap when he saw one, and he would wait to see how this played out before publicly castigating Mikkel. Which was all Mikkel needed.
"What matter is at hand?" Sedil asked.
Mikkel bowed again.
"By order of Yarat, we've come to arrest Devon Fagula on charges of murder and treason."
He half expected Sedil to bark a reply, to sweep in to cover for his cupbearer. Instead, the old man simply lifted his chin and narrowed his eyes as if to say, "Continue." So Mikkel did.
"We have evidence that Devon Fagula has conspired with enemies of the state in order to kill off her rivals among the Dainais."
Mikkel so very much wanted to say, "Your rivals," but he kept to his script. This had to fall on Fagula's shoulders, and hers alone. The bombings conducted by the Black Hats over the last few weeks were coordinated by Fagula.
"You have no evidence," Fagula said, finally finding her tongue.
She snatched up the list of addresses and crumpled it, throwing it at Mikkel's face.
"Just a damned bloody piece of paper."
Mikkel let the paper bounce off his cheek without comment.
"We do, actually. We have a second copy of that paper found among the effects of a captured black hat. We also have the word of that black hat that you worked with him directly. And that, great Kaa, is why Yarat has asked for your assistance. We formally request a Bonai inquisition of the black hat prisoner in question, followed by an inquisition into Fagula herself. We want to gain nothing but the truth, and we request that you aid us in that process."
To his credit, Sedil didn't even blink at the request. He remained silent for several moments, no doubt fully aware that the eyes of the Dainai's upper crust were on him. He looked coolly at Fagula, then at Mikkel.
"Of course," he said.
Fagula gave an anguished cry, lurching forward and snatching the sword from the Dainai soldier at Tennik's side.
"Stop her!"
Mikkel cried. Fagula leapt back, waving the sword once and looking Sedil in the face, before taking it by the blade and pressing the tip to her chest and falling upon it. Her sobbing was cut short, body spasming as her weight caused the blade to pierce her heart. She slumped, then fell to one side with a thump, a pool of blood immediately beginning to widen around her. Several of the crowd gasped. People attempted to step away from the blood. Kaa Sedil did not. So Mikkel didn't either.
"I'm sorry, great Kaa,"
Mikkel said gently in the silence. That was not at all how we wanted this to go.
It was exactly how they wanted it to go.
And just for an instant, when he raised his face from the gruesome display, Mikhail could see raw fury in Carr Sediel's eyes. Sediel knew this was what was meant to happen, and he knew that the message sent by this event came directly from Yaret, despite Yaret's absence. The fury was gone in the blink of an eye, replaced by the sad resolve of an old man. Carr Sediel shook his head, tutting, before raising his voice.
"May Devin Fogula's body be fed to the dogs," Sediel proclaimed, "and her name be forever struck from the records of the Sediel household. May she be crushed and forgotten. Such is the fate of a traitor."
His eyes landed on Mikhail's face on that final word, and Mikhail suppressed a shudder. He would not get out of this unscathed.
"That," he said quietly, "will not happen. Fagula will be remembered for what she was, and her crime publicized and recorded. Her name will be struck from your household records, but not the public ones."
Sediel's eyes narrowed.
"I make those decisions."
"I apologize, Great Carr, but you do not. The Ministry of Scrolls does."
"I see."
Sediel settled both hands on his cane, shoulders slumped as if he was a man under a great weight, and gazed into Mikhail's eyes in an almost placid manner for a few moments before hobbling off. The crowd gave way before him, and Mikhail watched as he tracked Fogula's blood down the hall, without seeming to care. Mikhail wondered if that was a metaphor for Carr Sediel's whole career, and decided not to pursue the thought any further. Slowly, the crowd began to move again. Conversation resumed, and people stopped staring at Mikhail or at the body at his feet. A pair of soldiers approached, checking Fogula for any sign of life before lifting her by the hands and feet and carrying her off.
"That was well done," Tenik said.
Mikhail let out a long breath. He dragged his sleeve across his brow and dabbed the sweat off the back of his neck.
"Whew, Pet, I'll never want to do that again." "That's too bad. You did it well enough that Yaret might use you again in the future."
"I'm a spy, dammit, not a constable."
Tenik tapped the cup insignia on Mikhail's uniform.
"You're whatever Yaret needs you to be, cupbearer."
"Don't remind me."
Tenik gave him a small smile.
"I will, and frequently. You still have a lot to learn."
"Don't I know it.
Have we gotten anything from Mahush?"
"The names of half a dozen more safe houses, and perhaps 30 plackets," Tenik answered.
"Do we know where Jatura is?"
"Mahush has no idea. He thinks that Jatura uses the catacombs beneath the sea to get around. But we've searched dozens of miles of that damn spider web and found little evidence of a giant network of black-hepped powder monkeys."
Mikhail growled in the back of his throat, frustrated. With Mahush handed over to the Bone Eyes, there would be no secrets left to learn, and he was their best chance of finding Jatura.
"Keep looking. Send more men into the catacombs if you have to."
He suddenly became aware that he and Tenik were not isolated in their conversation. He glanced over his shoulder to find Ictracia leaning against the wall a few feet behind him, just out of the pool of Fogula's blood, watching him with a tight-lipped smile.
"I'll see to the body,"
Tenik suddenly said.
"Tenik, wait,
Tenik was gone before Mikhail could stop him, leaving him alone with Ictracia. He turned, putting on his most charming smile.
"Good evening, Sheen Ictracia."
"Good evening, Devin Mikhail Ayaret."
Mikhail felt goosebumps on the back of his arms at the title. His smile faltered for a split second,
but he didn't think it Tracy had noticed. "I'm sorry for the mess," he said.
"I'm not the one standing in it," Ictracia said with a shrug.
Mikel looked down to realize that he was indeed standing in Fogula's blood. He lifted one foot, looked around for somewhere to wipe it, then gave up.
"What can I do for you, Sheen?"
"I'm curious. Did Sedjul put her up to it?"
Ictracia nodded to where Fogula's body had been a minute before.
"Of course not. She acted alone, against her enemies."
"You mean the enemies of the Sedjul household? I'm not stupid, Mikel, and I know who died in those explosions. None were allies of Sedjul."
Mikel licked his lips, glancing over his shoulder. The crowd had gotten out quickly, and he imagined that in a few minutes no one would be left but whatever poor sod of a soldier was tasked with cleaning up this blood. Most of the crowd had deftly avoided the pool, but the blood Calcediel tracked down the hallway was smeared everywhere.
"Was it that obvious?" he asked.
"It will be after the gossip has gone around the city a few times," Ictracia answered. "You showed everyone the math, after all."
"Good." Ictracia's eyebrows went up in surprise. Then she smiled.
"Oh, I see. Very clever. You want everyone to know that Sedjul has broken the Dionysus truce without actually calling him out in public. It erodes his power base without forcing him to respond immediately. Tell me, was this Yaret's idea or yours?"
Mikel shook his head.
"Oh, I'll bet it was yours. Yaret is a very intelligent man, but he's not much of a schemer. You, however..."
Ictracia stepped over to Mikel, putting her face just inches from Mikel's to look him in the eyes. She was shorter than he by over 2 inches, but he felt as if she were staring down at him. Mikel cleared his throat.
"I want to thank you again for saving my life."
"And how are you feeling?"
"Not fantastic, but it's better than being dead."
"Good. I suggest that you deliver on that dinner you offered me."
I'm afraid that my favourite restaurant burned down during the riots."
Mikel thought that his mouth should be dry, his heart hammering, but to his surprise he found that he was calmer now than he had been 10 minutes ago. Why would that be? Flirting with a privileged was infinitely more dangerous than arresting an enemy of the state. But, he realized, it was also more private, more intimate. This was what he knew how to do. A memory suddenly leapt to his mind of watching his mother's cat play with a mouse for several days. When asked, his mother told him that the mouse was the safest critter on the block, for as long as the cat found it entertaining.
"Your excuse fails to impress me," Ictracia noted.
"Perhaps you have a chef at your townhouse?" Mikel asked.
Yaret was a fine master, but Mikel had seen the fury in Sedjul's eyes. He needed someone who could protect him right now.
Ictracia cocked an eyebrow.
She opened her mouth, closed it, then grinned.
"I think you'll be a lot of fun," said the cat to the mouse, Mikel thought.
He linked arms with Ictracia, falling in beside her.
"Come, we must find somewhere to clean the blood from my shoes and pants."
Chapter 44. The Dionysus dragoons appeared within hours of the Mad Lancers leaving the safety of the Third Army and harassed them all along the length of the Hammer for 2 more days. On the third, Stike called for a rest at midday and sent for his officers.
"Why are they riding my ass so hard?"
Stike asked Carpole as he waited for his men to gather. Through his looking glass, he watched a Dionysus scout
wearing the now familiar turquoise jacket and black pants of the Dionysed Dragoons. The scout was about 3 miles away and, from the way he was standing out in the open, clearly wanted to be seen. The Dionysed were trying to get under his skin. They were succeeding.
"Eh?" he asked, lowering his glass. "Why do they dog me? Did that prick of a Dionysed commander order them after me as well?"
Carpole remained intractable, her face a mask of mild irritation, though whether that was directed at Stike, at the Dionysed, or at their slow progress across the hammer, he couldn't be sure. She finally shook her head. "I don't know." Stike made a vexed sound in the back of his throat. He'd been hunted plenty of times. The Kers had sent a whole field army after the Mad Lancers at one point during the war. But he'd never been ambushed so successfully as by these dragoons, nor followed so closely without his own scouts knowing exactly where the enemy was at all times. He was struck by a thought that brought a smile to his lips. It was not that funny, but he soon found himself roaring, slapping his knee, bent double. When he was finally able to stand, he turned to find Carpole's facade broken and an expression on her face that clearly asked, "What the pit is wrong with you?"
"Cossedil," he said, wiping a tear from his eye. "He must have been so incredibly pissed that someone crushed one of his dragon men. When he found out I was a cripple, I can just imagine his face."
He made Carpole suffer through another round of chuckles, then gasped for breath. Carpole smirked.
"I should write him a letter," Stike said. "Tell him that I killed another one, and that a third had a head blown off by a little girl."
His mirth was interrupted by the arrival of Ibana and Jackal. Ibana had a fresh cut across her cheek from where a Dionysed bullet had barely missed her face in a sortie less than 3 hours ago. They'd lost 7 Mad Lancers and only managed to down 2 of the Dionysed, and she was clearly not in a smiling mood. "What's so funny?" she demanded. Stike waved it off and forced himself to sober.
"Nothing. Nothing. Jackal, have you managed to wrangle any of your damn spirits so we can find out where these sons of bitches are going to hit us next?"
"I have, actually."
Both Ibana and Gusta adopted dubious expressions. Stike held a finger out to them.
"Only interrupt if you have any better ideas," he said.
They both remained silent and pointed to Jackal.
"There is one," Jackal said. "She was an officer until Ibana killed her 2 days ago. Their equivalent of a lieutenant. She does not fear Carpole like the others."
Carpole seemed mildly intrigued by this. Stike asked,
"Why not?"
"She will not say, and I can't coax it out of her. From what she tells me, the Dionysed are not..."
He paused, as if trying to come up with the right phrase.
"They are not of one mind."
"Divided?"
Stike asked. G. Orts had said as much. But it was interesting to have this confirmed by Jackal.
"They spent the better part of the last century locked in a bitter civil war. There were ultimately 2 sides and dozens of factions in each. She was a member of the side that eventually capitulated. She does not believe in Carsedior's plan to unite the country by invading Fatrasta, and she did not want to be here in the first place."
"And that's why she's talking to you?"
"That, and she thinks her commanding officer is an asshole."
Stike wondered briefly if this whole conversation was more evidence that he had come unhinged. If someone had claimed to speak with spirits back during the Old War, he would have sent them to the front of the next charge and hoped they either became a spirit themselves or got the sense knocked into them.
"I like her," Stike said, referring to the spirit. "Does she know why they're after us?"
"That's not important," Ibana cut in. "Does she know what their plan is?"
She gritted her teeth, and Snake could tell it annoyed her to ask Jackal a question for the spirits. Major Gustav remained silent, still looking sceptical.
"Their plan is to wear us thin," Jackal said. "They tried engaging us directly and lost more men than they'd expected. They will harass us until we reach the coast and then try to break us."
He paused.
"It seems they are not an ordinary cavalry unit."
"I could have told you that," Stike snorted.
"At the end of the Civil War, they were the other Emperor's bodyguard. Or rather, they are what's left of his bodyguard."
"I'm being chased by four dragomen and a damned Imperial Guard," Stike murmured to himself. "Karsh said he'll needs to learn to let things go." He cleared his throat. How far are we from the end of the hammer?"
Gustav spoke up.
"A few days at our current rate."
Stike mused over the possibilities.
"We could just ignore them until we reach the coast and they're forced to engage us."
"They'll bleed us dry,"
Gustav said.
"We're down to less than 600 able-bodied men. We could lose another 200 in those days. My guess is they still have 1,500 left. That would leave us outnumbered nearly 4-1.
"We face worse odds," Stike said.
Ibana put her hands on her hips.
"I'll remind you again. We had enchanted armor. Not everyone is able to walk off every engagement they end up in, Ben."
Stike frowned, considering his cavalier attitude toward the deaths of others. He knew commanding officers whose hearts bled for every death under their command. Lady Flint was one of those. To some, that was a weakness. Flint had turned it into a strength. He turned his gaze to the west, toward the end of the hammer, and, if Karpol was to be believed, their final destination. He wondered briefly at their end goal in regard to the Godstone. Whether they were to capture and hold it, or to destroy it, or to try to put it on a boat and sink it in the sea. He decided that was best left to Karpol. He, in turn, would take care of whatever killing needed done in order to get there. His eyes fell on the sharp terrain. The geography at the end of the hammer was a far different sight from the east coast of Fatrasta, where they'd begun. Gone were the plains, punctuated by bogs, lazy rivers, and plantation houses. Even gone were the forests and rolling hills of central Fatrasta. The terrain through which they must now pass was a dense wood filled with steep ridges and deep ravines covered in hanging mosses. It reminded Stike of the sharp foothills of the Iron Hook Mountains. But there were no mountains within hundreds of miles. The locals called it the Hawk. Superstitious people claimed that the Hawk had been carved by a war between gods millennia ago. During his time in the labor camps, Stike had once been partnered with a geologist, one of those government-employed fellows sent to look for likely deposits of gold ore, who had insisted that this sharp terrain had been caused by immense mountains of ice creeping their way across the land tens of thousands of years ago. Stike had always dismissed him as a lunatic.
"What will they expect us to do?"
Stike asked, still staring at the edge of the innocuous-looking forest that marked the beginning of the Hawk. Gustav answered straight away.
"They have us heavily in numbers. They'll expect one of two things, that we'll make a run for the coast in the mistaken belief we can find reinforcements from a Fatrastan fleet."
"Or," Stike asked,
"or that we try to hide in the Hawk, shake them loose, and double back. They know that we know we're outnumbered and running out of options. They'll expect us to use the Hawk as our chance to get away."
Ibana did not seem convinced. "There is a third option, that they know our reputation and expect us to turn and fight at the first opportunity."
Stike tried to put himself in the shoes of the Dragoon commander.
She was crafty enough to stay unnoticed all the way across the country and then catch them unawares in ambush. She also, so Stike assumed, had orders to kill Stike. Probably the same orders that Carsedul had given those dragon men. Would she go around the hawk and expect to catch up on the other side? Would she follow closely on his heels?
"Do we have scouts back from the hawk?"
he asked.
"We do," Ivana reported. "There's just one major road to the coast. It has one relay station that's still manned by 3 foot trusting troops, which means the Dianites have avoided the place entirely since they landed. So we shouldn't run into an army in there."
"And the dragoons haven't gone ahead of us?"
He looked back to where he'd spotted the scout to the east a few minutes ago, but they had disappeared.
"Absolutely certain of it," Gustar replied.
His two majors in agreement, Stike realized that rushing headlong into the forest had few consequences.
"Bring me your scouts, some paper, and something to draw with. I want to know exactly what the terrain looks like before we head in."
3 hours later, Stike crouched in the underbrush at the edge of the hawk, looking out onto the road that his troops had passed through not long ago. He could see clearly for almost a mile before the road curved over a hill. It was empty and quiet. Carpo lay beside him, using his looking-glass to scan the horizon. Celine was somewhere a couple of miles into the hawk with the camp and most of the horses. Ivana and Gustar were each about 300 yards to Stike's left and right, respectively, lying in much the same position at the edge of the forest, and waiting with bated breath for the Dianai's dragoons to show themselves. When Stike spotted the first scout, he rode not from the east, but from the south. The rider came up just a few dozen yards from the edge of the hawk, riding parallel to the forest, peering into the trees as he went. Stike ignored the twinge in his leg and pressed himself lower into the brush as the rider came near. The rider reached the road, an easy carbine shot from Stike's position, and stopped. Only a few minutes passed, and he was soon joined by another rider from the north, and then, crossing the distant hill and coming toward them, a third rider. They joined in conference for a few moments before the first and second riders headed into the hawk, following the trail of the mad lancers.
"Let them go," Stike whispered to Jackal.
The command was passed quietly along into the forest. Stike heard the clop of their hooves disappear and watched the third rider, who seemed content to wait. 15 minutes passed, then half an hour, and then the two scouts reappeared to join their third companion. They conferred once again, and the third took off back down the road.
"They'll report back to their superiors," Stike whispered to Carpole, "that were camped roughly 2 miles into the hawk, in an open hollow that would be easily ambushed. The rest of the army will be here soon. I want you to go back to camp and keep an eye on Celine."
Carpole gave him a thoughtful look and got to her feet, hurrying into the forest. In less than 20 minutes, horses appeared on the horizon. They rode 6 across, carbines held sharply at the ready. Stike recognized the woman at their head. It was the same officer who'd slaughtered his rear guard and then tried to kill him last week. The column continued to snake down the road, extending for nearly a mile, with room between the horses for them to maneuver. Stike guessed that they had a little under 1,400 riders, plus pack horses and spares. They entered the forest so close that Stike could have thrown a rock at that officer. He crouched, his fingers itching to grab for his carbine, and waited the agonizingly long time until the end of their column had entered the forest, before finally standing up. The men around him climbed to their feet and followed him as they headed into the woods, Following their tracks back to where they'd hidden their horses, a few hundred yards up a slate-carved ravine that wouldn't easily show their hoofprints. He had just 50 men with him, but they were his very best, lancers who'd been with him from the beginning. They reached their horses and donned their Dionysus breastplates, mounting up.
"Send the signal," he ordered.
Jackal cleared his throat and hooted loudly. The call was carried over the next hill, and a few moments passed before it came back to them from both the north and the south. Stike leaned forward in the saddle, waiting. Two more sets of hoots eventually followed, and Jackal nodded happily.
"They're in position," he reported.
Stike allowed a satisfied smile to cross his face and hefted his lance.
"Wait until the firing starts," he said.
Within minutes they heard the first stuttering report of a carbine salvo, followed by the screams of men and horses. Stike flipped Amrek's reins and allowed the horse to pick his way carefully down the winding ravine, followed by his 50 lancers. A forest was, as these things went, a terrible place for cavalry to ambush cavalry. There was little room to manoeuvre for either side, and steep ravines meant an easy fall for a panicking horse. However, it was an excellent place for dismounted soldiers who'd had a chance to hide themselves to ambush an enemy cavalry force. And that's just the ambush Ibana and Gustav's men had performed. Stike reached the end of the ravine and rejoined the main road, just in time to see the panicking rear guard of the Dionysus cavalry attempting some kind of counterattack. They were in utter disarray. A few had dismounted and leapt behind horses, or into the foliage looking for cover. Some scrambled about in a panic, reloading from horseback, and still others had attempted to charge their horses into the woods, only to find themselves easy pickings on the steep banks. A man with red epaulets stood in his stirrups, waving his carbine and shouting in an attempt to organize his men. Stike's lance clipped his arm, and Amrek's shoulder hit the rider's poor horse, sending both tumbling down into the ravine on the other side of the road. Stike and his lancers entered the thick of the Dionysus dragoons, ploughing through them with the momentum of a downhill charge, barely slowing to fight as they trampled or scattered everyone in their paths. They reached a switchback, arresting their charge just enough to turn, and then continued on down into the ravine. The road became a mess of horses and men. Stike traded his lance for a cavalry sabre and fought his way to the bottom of the ravine. The road levelled out, giving him a chance to regain momentum, and he and his men surged forward. This went on for well over half a mile, fighting, climbing, charging, hacking. The road wound as much as any mountain pass over ridges and through narrow valleys. Dismounted lancers spread along the entire trail, firing from the high points and retreating up the inclines if the Dionysus attempted to chase, while Stike charged through the middle of it to break up any possible semblance of Dionysus cohesion. He finally reached a long, straight bit of road, only to realize that he'd run out of dragoons to attack. The echoes of carbine blasts were all behind him now, and he searched the forest for the woman with the orange epaulets. There was no sign of her head, nor evidence that she'd fled into the woods. He joined the mounted lancers as they caught up with him, finding Jackal bloodied and sagging, the mad lancer's flag flying from a broken lance in his outstretched hand.
"Wounded?"
Stike demanded.
"I'll be fine."
Jackal's eyes shone.
"We ride through them once more?"
Stike assessed his riders. Less than half remained from the initial charge, more than he'd expected to make it. He flipped his reins and headed back down the road a few hundred feet, surveying the bodies of Dionysus dragoons and the riderless horses running scared. He stopped twice to kill horses beyond help, and finished off several wounded dragoons. He found a few spots where hoofprints indicated that dragoons had fled into the forest, but still no sign of the woman with the orange epaulets. He returned to Jackal.
We took a damned risk on those roads. I saw at least a dozen of us go down with lame horses. We wait here for Ibana, and only head back if we hear a signal.
The signal, a trumpet's call, never came, and several hours passed while the blast of carbines became less and less frequent. Stike and his riders let their horses rest, tending to their wounds. Jackal had taken a bullet in the thigh. Stike's face was scratched to pit by branches, and his calf was sliced by a dragoon's sword. The same sword had cut a nasty groove down Amrek's flank, so Stike cleaned and stitched the wound. He inspected Amrek's hooves for cracks, and tested his legs to make sure they hadn't been hurt charging up and down the steep roads. It was beginning to grow dark in the hollows of the Hawk when Ibana, still on foot, limped into sight. She was followed by a long column of dismounted lancers, and they continued on toward camp as Ibana leaned against the moss-covered stump of a fallen tree. She rubbed her leg, grimacing, and looked up when Stike approached.
"You'll look well rested," she said.
"I didn't want to send the horses back along those roads."
She waved him off.
"That was the right call. How did it go?"
"I lost 26 riders. I imagine a few just lost their horses."
Stike spotted one of his old guard carrying her saddle, walking with the dismounted soldiers.
"How about you?"
7 dead."
Stike raised his eyebrows.
7?
7 dead, about 60 wounded."
A sly smile spread on Ibana's face.
"We butchered the shit out of those slippery bastards. They didn't expect a damn thing."
"Did you make a count?"
"We counted 830-some dead or wounded dragoons."
She waved back down the road.
"Felicia and her scouts are gathering all the good horses they can find and bringing them with."
"The wounded?" Stike asked.
"Left where they lie," Ibana said dispassionately. "If their friends come find them, they might live. If not..."
She shrugged. Stike walked Amrek beside Ibana all the way back to the Mad Lancers' camp. They'd left behind 50 men to set up tents and act as a guard, and they reported that none of the Dianais had come this direction. Stike found Selene, and the two of them watched while Sunantil stitched the bullet graze on Ibana's leg.
"It was a good victory?"
Selene asked.
"A very good victory,"
Stike answered. He felt strangely melancholic. As Ibana said, they'd absolutely slaughtered the poor bastards. Less than half of the enemy force remained, and if they wanted to press the issue, they'd have to fight 1-to-1 with the Mad Lancers now. That should have sent his spirits soaring, but something felt off. Perhaps it was the ambush. Anyone could have been caught with their pants down in the Hawk. Stike liked a good ambush as well as anyone, but a straight fight always felt better to him. The enemy commander's greed had gotten the better of her. He did the rounds, Selene by his side, checking in with the sentries and scouts, and doubling their nighttime guard against an unlikely enemy regrouping before he headed to his tent. He lay back, using Amrek's saddle for a pillow, and was preparing to drift off when he realized what was wrong. He didn't smell blood. He found Ibana still doing her own rounds, startling her as he came out of the darkness.
"Why aren't you wearing pants?" she asked.
"I was in my tent," Stike answered. "Have you seen Carpole anywhere?"
"Come to think of it, no. Not since before the ambush."
Stike flared his nostrils, breathing in deeply. The scent of her sorcery, which had become so ubiquitous over the last few weeks, was nowhere on the wind.
"You sent her back here, didn't you?"
Ibana asked. Stike recounted his footsteps. They'd been watching the Dianai scouts, and then he'd dismissed Karpol to return to the camp before the fighting started. There was no way she had gotten lost.
"Ben?"
a voice asked. Stike turned to find Celine, rubbing her eyes.
"Go back to bed,"
he said gently.
"Wait. Did Karpol return to camp earlier?"
"Yeah,